So we are with Colin Blakemore, who is currently Professor of Neuroscience at Oxford and Warwick Universities, was former Chief Executive of the Medical Research Council, and Wainfleet Professor of Physiology, University of Oxford, and a whole list of other things. I see here new President of the Motor Neuron Disease Association, appointed as Chair for the General Advisory Committee on Science, the Food Standards Agency. We'll get into all of these things. What this plainly says is an extremely engaged scientist who's interested in public affairs and science and society issues, and I want to get into that in a moment. Let me just first context this by saying that we actually are in Science Network's home at the moment, which is the old Francis Crick House, and when you arrived here, you mentioned that it brought back lots of memories of Francis. So why don't you share that with us for a moment?
Well, I had the great good fortune to visit the Salk Institute for a number of summers, actually, to work here with partly with Max Cowan, with Terry Sanofsky, and with Francis. Francis was a host for one of the visits, so I got to know Francis very well. Right here, difficult to walk past the pool without conjuring up an image of Francis holding court over usually a group of very attractive, scantily clad foreign girls who are being painted by Odile. So it brought back lots of nice memories. Although I knew Francis much earlier than that. I first met Francis, I suppose, in the early 70s in Cambridge, where I was a very young member of the faculty. And Francis was still at the Laboratory of Molecular Biology on Hills Road, the MRC, the extraordinary MRC Centre, this sort of Nobel Prize factory. And Francis and his entourage of molecular biologists came down from the LMB for a visitation, unprecedented visitation, for a seminar that I gave, a departmental seminar, which is pretty intimidating. I don't think I'd met him before. And I remember him. He's just moving into neuroscience, his interest in neuroscience just developing then. But I gave a talk on work I'd been doing, which was pretty controversial at the time, on the plasticity of the developing visual system, the way in which the environment influences the development of the visual system, which ran counter to most of the conventional views about sort of rigidly genetically organized programming of the nervous system. And I had lots of exciting results. Easily enough content for an hour's presentation, masses of data. I knew that there was one weak link in my argument. I was describing the way in which neurons of the visual cortex have their individual response properties changed by the visual experiences of the animal. In particular, individual neurons in the adult, cat and monkey, in this part of the cortex, respond selectively to lines and edges in the visual field. Different cells respond to different orientations. And if you grow up an animal, a cat, or I suspect this must be true of monkeys and of people too, in an environment in which the predominant input in their visual experience is lines of a particular orientation, then you find that the distribution, the population of neuron responses becomes biased. There are more cells that respond to the things the animal's seen and fewer that respond to the orientations the animal hasn't seen. The weak link was that the cortex is organized, and beautifully shown by David Hubel and Torsten Wiesel, anatomically organized into little modules, groups of cells responding to different orientations. And that basic layout is pre-programmed. And at that stage, actually, people thought it was much more pre-programmed than I think they probably think it is now. So the problem is, you know, if it's pre-programmed, how can it be different as a result of experience? If there was no organization to begin with, then you could understand that cells become programmed by their input. So I knew that the presence of this exquisitely organized columnar system, beautifully laid out, certainly genetically determined in its basic pattern, I knew that that was a weak link in all of the argument, the nice argument that the environment just imposes its statistical properties on the brain. So I didn't mention it.
So
and nobody else spotted it. And not a single question had ever been raised in any seminar I gave until Francis raised his hand. At the end of the talk, he said, there's just one problem with this argument. What about the columns, these modules of cells? And I have to say, that set my standards of respect for Francis Crick forever.
Was he, at this point, he came to the Salk in, well, he'd obviously been associated with the Salk a long time earlier with the planning and so on, and Bronowski and all those sorts of things, but he physically moved here in 77, I think it was, late 76, early late 77, and then became interested in consciousness. Was he talking about consciousness when you saw him at that point?
No, he was interested, he was clearly interested in the nervous system, but it was in a stage of, as it were, absorbing masses of data. At the stage when I first met him, and I think, as I said, it must have been about 1972, 73 maybe, consciousness hadn't yet become his primary interest. He was just moving into study of the nervous system, interested in the nervous system, and absorbing information and ideas at a prodigious rate. And he was certainly very much influenced and affected by the ideas of a brilliant young mathematician, David Marr, who tragically died very young, I think at the age of 35, had worked with Giles Brindley, had done brilliantly in mathematics at Cambridge, and wrote about the organization, the structure of the brain in computational terms. I mean, a really revolutionary idea that you could look at the anatomy of the brain, counting the number of synapses and the distribution of cells, looking at the input and output connections, and from that derive a computational model of how it worked. Very current views now, but quite revolutionary then. And Francis, being quantitative in his own way of working, was very much influenced by Marr's ideas. So he was interested in memory, which is an area that Marr had worked on, the control of movement, how the brain forms representations of the outside world, and I guess that's what gradually stimulated his interest in consciousness.
Yeah. I remember when you came to, there's a meeting that Terry Sanofsky runs called the Helmholtz Club. I remember that was an occasion when Francis, I remember he did this with Richard Gregory as well. Although he could ask brilliant pointed questions, he could also be pretty harsh at sometimes as well.
Well, I think I remember that, of course, seminar vividly. It was a harrowing experience. It was clearly a kind of testing ground for the alpha male characteristics of the brilliant postdocs in this area. So there's a lot of tension between people to ask the most cutting and damaging question. But also, and it was to some extent orchestrated by Francis. And I have to say that it didn't affect my regard or friendship for Francis at all, but he was incredibly aggressive. I think I didn't help by setting the context of what I've talked about by referring in obliquely to a paper that he'd just published in Nature with Christoph Koch, which basically argued that consciousness cannot be mediated by the very first receiving area for vision in the brain, the primary visual cortex, and there were arguments in favour of that. It can't be mediated by the primary visual cortex, and that consciousness was central to the way in which the representational systems of the brain work, and it's a very important part of the processing of the brain. So I started my talk very flippantly by saying that I was going to argue that conscious perception is mediated by the primary visual cortex and that it's of no functional value at all. So, right. Francis was pretty riled by that beginning and proceeded to sort of tear apart my hypothesis. But it was a good experience.
I remember I was there and it was interesting. Somebody once said that Francis would have listened to you for 20 minutes, but after 20 minutes, if you hadn't got it right, then he would tend to sort of let loose.
I mean, Francis was a formidable opponent in discourse about science, but I have to say that however fiercely he would defend a point, if he recognised in the end that there were weaknesses in the argument, he would be the first to concede. And that brings back another memory at Cold Spring Harbour meeting on synaptic function, a very important meeting. When he was in full flight, now was it before or after the dreaded Helmholtz Club? I think it was before the dreaded Helmholtz Club event, but I met him there and he at that stage was developing his ideas about the oscillatory activity, electrical activity of the brain, somehow mediating aspects of consciousness, being necessary for consciousness, and being associated with what's called the binding problem, the way in which we are able to integrate in our conscious experience things and events and activity that are happening in very different parts of the brain. How can that be done? So it had been suggested, and particularly by Wolf Singer in Germany, that the phase locking of responses in different parts of the brain, might be another element in the coding of neurons, quite distinct from the individual signals that they give. So the degree of correlation of activity could add to the information being conveyed by individual neurons, and particularly could solve the binding problem. And Francis was very impressed with that idea, and it became gradually, with Christoph Koch, the basis of an idea of consciousness that it was driven by the oscillatory activity of the brain. And I said, it's an idea that I have to say I've never felt immediately attracted to, partly because it's difficult to see how it's read out. I mean, who's doing the reading? It's a bit sort of Cartesian in its problems, that although the information might be there, you as an external observer looking at brainwave activity can see that the information added by the oscillations is there. Who's doing the looking in a way that makes it useful to the way that an organism works? So I said, I remember again very flippantly saying to Francis, when he was expounding these ideas with great enthusiasm to everybody, I said, Francis, I'll give it 10 years. He said, what do you mean I'll give it 10 years? I said, I'll give it 10 years before the average graduate student, if you say the word synchronization to them, will say, synchronization? And of course, what I was saying was I didn't think the idea of phase-locked activity as such, synchronized or oscillating activity, would persist and be important. And I think I'm right, actually, because oscillation isn't a word that's used very often. People talk about time locking of responses, but the idea of this strict oscillatory activity is not quite in vogue as it was. But that clearly made Francis very angry. However, he, both in print and in person, just a few years later, said that idea was probably wrong. Yeah. And I have to concede it was a nice idea, but it was probably in detail wrong.
If you go back to the talk you first described there, you're talking about experimental work that you were doing, which really became the basis of the controversy which has dogged you, or has become a part of your life, I must say, ever since, which is this whole animal experimentation issue, which is the thing that brought you to Los Angeles yesterday, a debate about whether this was an appropriate... Do you want to give us some context on that, what yesterday's debate was about, and whether this has all moved forward in the 30-odd years that you've been fighting this fight?
Well, the context for yesterday's debate was at least in part an email exchange that I've had over the last 4 or 5 years with a guy called Dario Ringach from UCLA. A visual scientist, and I mean, as he pointed out to me yesterday, he's a scientific grandchild of me, because he worked with and studied with Mike Hawken at NYU, and Mike was a postdoc with me. So there's a clear familial connection there. And he did very elegant work on analysis of vision in monkeys. And he was targeted here in Southern California by the now very active and rather scarily aggressive anti-vivisection movement, animal rights movement. He has young kids, and, you know, as happens, his kids, his family, he were threatened. There'd been some pretty serious incidents in the area. And when a fellow member of the department had an incendiary device left on their front porch... Well, actually, not on their front porch, on a neighbor's, because they made a mistake in where they placed it, but still, the concern was the same. Dario wrote to his critics through an email and displayed on websites that he was conceding. He said, okay, you win, I'm giving up research on animals. And he has. He's been supported very well by UCLA and by his department and by his colleagues, but clearly this had a huge impact on his life. And I have to say, I admire him enormously, because you know, could have said, okay, that was his way of getting out of the problems. What he's done is to focus his energy on the more generic issue of how to respond to the criticisms of animal research, and invested a lot of effort into trying to encourage debate and engagement on this issue, despite his own personal experience and the fact that his career has been very significantly influenced by it. So the idea of debate grew out of an exchange and discussion about the difference of experience in the UK and in parts of the US, where this problem has suddenly become, you know, very heightened. And I pointed out to Dario that the efforts to engage, offering the opportunities at least of discussion and debate, the growing number of scientists in the UK who were willing publicly to discuss the issues, to talk about their work, I think has been enormously valuable in our experience. So he's been trying to encourage that here, and the debate yesterday, I think, was the first step in a process of trying to identify those in the opposition who are at least willing to talk, to try to find whether there's any common ground, and most important of all, where there are remaining differences of opinion, to define their basis, whether they're simply, as it were, ethical differences, unshiftable ethical differences, or whether there's some factual basis for differences which therefore ought to be capable of being resolved.
And where does that go? I mean, are there, what was your sense of the discussion? Are there actual ethical differences that people are willing to take these do-or-die postures on?
Well, I think so, and I hope so, in a sense. I mean, I have much more respect for an argument that goes as follows. I don't care about the obvious evidence that we have benefited from animal research in the past. I don't care about the medical advances that have been produced or could be produced in the future. I am appalled by the idea of exploiting living creatures for our benefit, living creatures that can suffer just as we can suffer. I suppose that's the way the argument would go. Therefore, I don't want it. Now, if that moral position is consistently held by an individual, which would mean, of course, refusing access to the treatments which are known to have depended on animal research, then I have great admiration for that position. But I would say, you know, we live, but what I have much less respect for is the argument that goes, or parody of it, goes as follows. Researchers who use animals are out of date, arcane scientists, out of touch with mainstream biomedical research, which has moved on. They're unaware of, or they ignore the availability of, all the alternatives which now exist. Nothing needs to be done on animals anymore. And moreover, the work that has been done on animals has never produced any benefit. It's all a historical fiction. The drugs are all dangerous because of the differences between animals and human beings. And really, the only thing that really matters is in the end is research on humans, and we should just do away with this. That's a sort of parody of, as it were, a scientifically based argument against animal research. To my mind, that is just a rewriting of history and a misrepresentation of fact. So I have huge respect for what the philosophers would call a deontological position, an absolute moral position that it's just wrong to use animals, whatever the benefit, compared with the argument that there's no benefit anyway.
I mean, we're obviously not going to solve this one in the course of this conversation. Does the argument then go on? Do people also talk about animal rights in terms of the way that animal liberation that Peter Singer would talk about it? Do they talk about, never mind using animals in animal experimentation, do they eat animals? Do they wear animals and so on? Does the debate go in that direction, or is it focused on the experimentation?
Of course, that question of the whole range of ways in which human beings exploit, use, and abuse animals was brought up. And actually, it's always struck me as surprising that of all the ways in which humans have made use of animals, you know, eating them, of course, wearing bits of them, hunting them, keeping them in circuses and in zoos, or as pets, beasts of burden, using them in medical research is the only one for which the stated goal is not just pleasure. All the rest just have to do with gratification and pleasure of human beings. At least the stated objective, it might be wrong, is to try to produce benefits to people and indeed to animals through the knowledge that's gained. And it seems very odd then that one use of animals should be singled out for such vitriolic criticism. I mean, I think it's perfectly consistent to have different moral positions on the use of animals in research and those other ways in which we use animals. And at the first protest demonstration, this curious movement set up to try to demonstrate public support for animal use in opposition to the many demonstrations against its use in Oxford a few years ago, the most gratifying thing I saw in a crowd of 1,000 people supporting animal use was a big sign that said vegetarians for animal research. And it wasn't a joke. It's actually sort of deeply significant philosophy in showing that people could hold a different moral position on the question of eating animals for pleasure, where there's, you know, it's not necessary, and animal research which is aimed at benefit.
So there's several places here, obviously, that one has looked at where you've been asked these questions before, and you seem to have some fairly clear positions on this. So it says here, and I'm quoting here, and this therefore may be incorrect, Sholto Burns, he is particularly withering about the animal rights philosophy of Peter Singer. Of course, animals don't have rights, he says. The reason I don't mistreat my own cat is not because it has some kind of rights, it's because I try to be a decent person. Our primary responsibility is to our own species, mosquitoes, swatum, and none of this pseudo-Buddhism. Now, I know you said that in a... But sort of in general, you don't eat mammals, you try and avoid chicken, but no major issue about it, and you know a fair number of animal researchers are vegetarians. So there's pros and cons. Your particular line that you've elected to defend at this point is that you think we have a preferential right to our own species. Is that roughly it?
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't like the word right, actually. Okay. And you made that clear in your quote. I think we've just kind of got it wrong in couching our discussion of responsibilities in terms of the rights of others on whom those responsibilities project. I think we just got it wrong. I think that even the concept of human rights is a mistake. And that's not to say I'm not a supporter of the principle of controlling the way that, or regulating our behaviour towards each other. But I think we got it wrong to express it in terms of rights rather than responsibilities. And just to rephrase the quote about cats, I mean, the same is true of human beings. I mean, I would hope that... you know, you and I wouldn't be respectful towards people of a different colour just because declarations on human rights tell us that that's what should be the case. We should do it because it's deep inside us that, you know, that is part of human, should be part of human nature, to be decent and good to each other and not to think, oh my goodness, I mustn't dislike this person because the Bill of Human Rights say that they have rights that I shouldn't be nasty to.
Except that plainly people were nasty to other people who didn't have the same skin colour, and it took a declaration of rights to get people to think about
these issues.
So in the same way, maybe it takes all this agitation to get people to think about animals in a different way. I mean, I could make that argument.
I'm not saying there shouldn't be a declaration, that it's needed, but it should have been a declaration of responsibilities. And that would make then the discussion about the relevance of that to animals a lot easier. Because one of the hang-ups that I and certainly many people have is the notion that there is sort of some God-given property that surrounds anything that has rights, whether it's a tree or a cat or a green fly. Or another person. I mean, the origin of one's relations with other things comes from within you. And if we want to specify it in declaration, it should be in those terms rather than the characteristics of the individual. I mean, something that cannot declare its rights has great difficulty in asserting them and in making those rights respectable. And that's what I think many people find difficult about the notion of animal rights, because animals don't stand up and say, just a minute, I'm protesting for my rights and I want this declaration honoured. Doesn't mean that because animals can't claim their rights that we haven't got responsibilities towards them. The onus is on us, not on the person to whom you know, this nebulous concept of rights have been given.
I remember when we were doing one of the Beyond Belief meetings, which the Science Network puts on, that's Harry Crotter was here, Sir Harold Crotter. I remember him saying at one point, you know, if fish had vocal cords, there'd be far few people eating fish. So there has to be this... kind of attention paying.
Sure. I mean, declarations and laws are often, as it were, a substitute for the capacity of individuals who are discriminated against to be able to express their own concerns. And that's absolutely fine. The mentally ill, underprivileged groups who don't have access to the media, don't have a voice to declare their wishes, have to be defended in other ways. But it needn't be done through conveying on them this curious concept of rights. I think it's much more effectively done by specifying the way in which individuals should behave towards others.
Right. Now,
It would be...
it's tricky.
Do you not want to rob a bank because you know that it's illegal to rob banks? Or do you not want to rob a bank because, well, it never occurs to you that that would be a decent, reasonable thing to do? Oh, do we want to live a life in which we are prohibited from doing things, or a life in which we are encouraged to do things? Of negative constraints on action or positive encouragements to action?
That's tricky. That's the sort of topic that we've dealt with at some of these Beyond Belief meetings, and in fact, and you know the research in terms of whether people are innately altruistic or not. It's a very dodgy area to get into, plainly. A lot of people would espouse Kantian ideals to say why they don't do certain behaviours, because if everybody did, then the place would be a mess, right?
Yeah.
Although, again, you could make a counter-argument to that.
I'm not a supporter of the naturalistic fallacy that things must be right if that's the way they are, which, I mean, some sociobiologists have argued that there is a fundamental and absolute human nature, presumably genetically determined, which is bound to rule our lives and which can serve as the basis of a reasonable system for life. We know that the brain is plastic. We've just been discussing it.
In fact, it says in Wikipedia that was one of your great contributions to science, is work on early work on plasticity.
This has certainly been one of the most substantial changes of thinking in brain research in my lifetime, the recognition that the brain, with all its complexity, is probably the most modifiable part of our body, and that is responsible not just for obvious things like what we can remember and things that we've learned how to do, like riding a bicycle, which obviously can't have been genetically programmed in advance. The genes didn't know about bicycles. But also has had huge ramifications for the way in which we interact with each other, learning from each other, building culture, acquiring knowledge gradually, producing the fabric of everything we've done, you know, from cathedrals to the scientific method. All of that's dependent on the plasticity of our brains. And that plasticity then is capable of creating new brains. Although our genetic makeup is essentially indistinguishable from that of the first Homo sapiens, 100,000 years ago or whatever, clearly we are different people. The way we live is totally different. And that is acquired. It's not genetically determined. The ability to be that way is genetically determined, but the individual content of all that huge memory is gone. Imagine that we could just eliminate at a stroke, and heaven knows we probably will do it fairly soon, all of the knowledge of humanity. And a few people left. They won't know all these things. They won't know how science works. They have to start from scratch. So it's not built into our brains or our genes. It's acquired. So even our moral structures, although there should be some sort of fundamental biological underpinning of that, just as there's a fundamental biological underpinning of, you know, we are organisms and the way we live our lives, we have layered on top of it all kinds of things that we've acquired through learning, collective learning together. And they're just as much a part of our brains as the things that were genuinely laid down immutably by our genetic heritage. So you can see the thread of genetic influence in our codes of practice, in our moral behaviour, in our laws and so on. But it's a pretty thin thread, really. I mean, what are the absolute taboos that you find in all human groups, which you might then be entitled to say are the genetically determined basis of morality? Incest taboos, pretty much universal. Bit of a concern about murder. Not many people eat each other, but that's not absolute. I mean, there are very few things that you can define which are absolutely consistent through all human groups and one might point to as the really secure basis of morality. Morality is a movable feast. It's reinvented, or at least it is built progressively from generation to generation.
Yeah. Were you being flippant then, or when you were saying, of course, there probably won't be much left pretty soon? I mean, do you have this sort of fatalistic sense that we're about to blow ourselves up or something?
Well, I mean, I'm an optimist by nature, and I certainly hope it doesn't happen, but my goodness, the probabilities seem fairly high that we'll do away with ourselves within the next 100 years or so, through one route or another, and it might not just be, nuclear warfare, but, I mean, it could now be, environmental impact, problems with food supply and food security and all of those kinds of things. We do seem to be heading into what John Beddington, the chief scientific advisor in the UK, is fond of calling a perfect storm. The accumulation of all these different things, problems, for which humanity seems to be at least partly, if not primarily, the cause.
So let's in fact come back to this, because you've written on Copenhagen recently, on global warming. You've got some views on other issues like aging population and so on and so on. I'd like to get into those, but before we just leave that subject of why you came here, you must, when you heard about Dario Ringetsch's case, have felt it was like it was deja vu all over again, as they say. It says here in The Observer that when you were doing that work, and I'm not saying that you were totally the only person working on plasticity, there was lots of stuff going on, but he and his family endured assaults by masked terrorists, bombs sent to his children, letters laced with razor blades, a suicide bid by his wife, it says here, and more than a decade of attacks and abuse. I mean, that sounds like a pretty nasty thing to have lived through. Has the climate changed, or
beyond all recognition? And I'm very, pleased to have lived long enough to, despite the efforts of some, to have seen the change. The situation in the UK in the 90s, and then in different ways in the early part of this century, was certainly just as bad as in Southern California now, and the problems in a way were more widespread.
Was this accurate, by the way, this thing from The Observer?
I think those things did happen. It was for 15 years. I was targeted in 1987, which was a year after the introduction of new legislation. In fact, the new legislation was actually formally in operation from the beginning of January 1987, after 100 years. I mean, the first laws in the world controlling animal legislation were in the UK in the 1876 Act, and it wasn't replaced. And that's an indication, actually, of how good it was. The legislation wasn't replaced until 1986, new set of laws. And the activists who had played part in a discussion about the new law, I mean, certainly weren't happy with it, but they looked in detail at it to see if there was any part of it that they could use to pursue their lobbying and their activity. And they saw in the preamble to this new act a statement that regardless of all the mechanisms that were in place to decide whether to give a scientist a license to perform experiments, the Secretary of State, the Minister at the Home Office responsible, would have the overruling right to change a license or to withdraw a license if there were public outcry against a particular area of research. So they saw this as a possible kind of loophole in the law that they could exploit. So, and I know the people very well who planned it. I spent a lot of time just talking with them afterwards. They planned to identify someone who could be the source of that public outcry, and to use that as a way of getting a license changed and then perhaps moving on categories of licenses, outcry, change, and so on. And they chose me by process of elimination. I mean, it's hard to fault them in a way, even though I would deny to the end the kinds of specific accusations they made. They wanted someone working on familiar animals rather than mice and rats, because they didn't think there was much sympathy. I worked on cats. They wanted someone working on vision, because people are very sensitive about their eyes, anyone touching eyes. I worked on vision. They wanted someone working on development, because, you know, young animals are even more pitiful and helpless, and the image of interfering with little kittens, pet kittens, you know, it was just horrendous. So I was just perfectly made the campaign, because I was working on the development of vision in cats. And moreover, some of my work involved closing the eyelids of kittens, you know, suturing the eyelids of kittens at birth, letting them grow up and then seeing, reopening the eyes, seeing the consequences on the brain. Not a technique that I developed, Hubel and Wiesel developed it. Part of their citation for the Nobel Prize is about that area of incredibly important work. But I mean, I was singled out for continuing to do that kind of work. So suddenly, March 1987, all hell broke loose in my life with no warning at all. Parades in the streets, pamphlets everywhere, planted newspaper articles. I mean, just everything. Every college in Oxford bombarded with stuff, telling them to condemn their junior common rooms, to condemn my work and so on. It was really incredible. And very soon after, as it were, the legitimate campaign, because all of this was, you know, without any threat of violence, the activists moved in and the sinister phone calls and emails began and so on, and it grew in pace. The people who had launched the campaign, I think, got alarmed by the way its character was changing and dissociated themselves from it, actually, fairly quickly. But it just gained a life of its own, and a very unpleasant life of its own. Which affected my existence and that, and when they discovered my home address, that of my family, for 15 years.
The research that you were working on was correct me if I'm... This is an old memory, and it may be completely wrong, but as I was reading this, it said that your work was relevant to how conditions like amblyopia, the most common form of child blindness, and the wandering eye and so on, developed. I had some vague memory somewhere that one of your daughters actually had that problem. Am I misremembering?
This is Sarah, my eldest daughter, who's also a neuroscientist, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
She has amblyopia, yeah.
So you were, in fact, also working on something that was of interest to your family?
Indeed, although I have to say the work began before Sarah was born.
Oh, okay.
And before I knew that she was amblyopic. And she is still amblyopic, so, you know, I'd love to be able to say my work prevented my daughter from getting this condition. It didn't. And it's although the work very much illuminated the condition and did provide, you know, at least clues about how it might be prevented. It's not an easy condition to spot and to diagnose in advance, and unless we had entirely different ways of screening kids to pick it up early enough. I mean, the principal message from the work was this condition can be corrected by correcting the conditions that cause it, but only very, very early in life. So we've got to pick it up very early in life, and that requires a different sort of screening from the methods that we use routinely these days.
All right. You mentioned, by the way, that Dario is, in a sense, one of your intellectual offspring.
Yeah.
I noticed also that you are, in that sense, your father, in scientific terms, was Horace Barlow, with whom we had a conversation recently on Science Network. So it's nice to... And then the Wainfleet Professor of Physiology... That goes all the way back to Sherrington. So you're a descendant of Sherringtons as well. What was the phrase he used about the brain, about the loom?
The enchanted loom.
The enchanted loom, yeah. So there's a wonderful history.
Nice turn of phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are these sort of genealogical trees that you can Google into these days, which show the lineage of science. And I'm very proud. You know, one step back is, of course, you know, Horace Barlow, Fergus Campbell, William Rushton, and so on. And then just another generation back from that, it's Sherrington, it's Adrian, and Michael Foster, and all these extraordinary luminaries of science. It shows actually how short the connections are between science, between science and scientists over generations. But I mean, I'm very proud to see that lineage.
Let's go back to the thing I mentioned at the beginning, the engagement of scientists with society, which is obviously one of the primary areas that we're dealing with at the Science Network, this creation of an agora or public square, discussing issues at the intersection of science and social policy. When we first started this network, and the launch event was about 5 years ago, it was the meeting on stem cells that we did, which you attended and spoke at, Stem Cells, Science, Ethics and Politics at the Crossroads. I remember making a case that the number of people in the U.S. House of U.S. Congress with any kind of scientific background at all, including MDs, was down around 5 or something like that. It was fairly pathetic in terms of a major technological industrial society. Whereas, I said proudly, back in the UK, of course, lots of people in the House of Commons and so on. And I just heard you on the phone recently in support of the MP for Oxford, trying to get some support, mentioning the fact that he was one of the few people now who actually had any evidence-based scientific credentials and so on. Has there been a shift? I mean,
I suspect, Roger, that in referring to the expertise in Parliament in the UK, you were really referring to the House of Lords. The representation of science and medicine has never been very high in the Commons, in the elected chamber. But, you know, paradoxically, in the entirely undemocratic appointed second chamber in the UK, in the House of Lords, there's much greater representation, because the basis of appointment of the House of Lords now has nothing to do with families, and that's gone. There are no new inherited peerages being created, and only a small fraction of the present members of the House of Lords are part of the old inherited peerage. But new appointments to the House of Lords are made on the basis of merit, of achievement in society, of professional standing rank, with some attention to the balance of different disciplines, including science and medicine. So there's actually pretty good representation of science and medicine in the Lords, including such people as Lord May, Lord Krebs, that is Bob May and John Krebs, right. Bob, previous chief scientific advisor, John Krebs, the founder of the Food Standards Agency and very influential in evidence-based policy. So the quality of debate and discussion about these issues in the Lords is of a really remarkably high standard. But I think people are worried about the Commons and its composition, and particularly worried about the potential change at the forthcoming general election, worried that there will not be the proper knowledge of and representation of science, of evidence, of medicine that is increasingly needed in determining policy. I mean, if there's one achievement of the present government which I'd really point to and highlight, it is the commitment not only to the support of science, but to the use of evidence and scientific advice in determining government policy. I think that's been an incredible change, actually, over the last 10 years or so. So it's very worrying if the House of Commons, responsible for creating new policy, doesn't have the wherewithal and the expertise to be able to judge scientific evidence.
So you think the last decade or so has been positive in that sense, in terms of the...
Amazing. I mean, there are only two countries in Europe which have chief scientific advisors, one being the UK. But the UK doesn't just have a chief scientific advisor. It now has a chief scientist for every government department except one. And that's the Treasury. which is odd, given the power of the Treasury through the whole of government, and there's a lot of debate and discussion about that fact, and I suspect there will be a chief scientist of the Treasury as well soon. So it's remarkable, and this is a real commitment, an expression of the government's commitment to evidence-based policy, to have a chief scientific advisor in every government department, and to make use of external independent scientific advice to feed into and to underpin policy throughout government.
Okay, I want to make some parallels here. Well, obviously, with the new Obama administration and so on, the presence of, you know, Harold Varmus, Linda, and so on and so forth, various people, seen as a positive sign. You nevertheless had some run-ins as when you were running the Medical Research Council with the government. I mean, you took a stance about their not supporting scientists who were in favour of animal experimentation, right? There was even a suggestion that the standard award of a knighthood on vacating that position, which you didn't get, was a result precisely because somebody in government sort of took a knife to you at some point. I mean, this doesn't sound like it quite meshes with what you just said about evidence-based science.
Well, there's a tension here, you know, and the tension is explicitly recognised, actually. It was identified, and this tension is between the value of evidence, which means, you know, scientists and experts, and the advice they provide, and the ultimate absolute responsibility of the government, of our elected representatives, to make policy, to decide what to do. And there's clearly a tension between those two things. You could just say, well, let's forget about government. If we're really committed to evidence-based policy, let's just let a bunch of scientists run the country. I'm not sure that would be a good thing. I suspect they'd get the... For one thing, how would they manage the budget? I mean, their priorities would probably be dominated by their concerns about funding for science and so on, and that's not the only issue. So putting together the responsibility of elected representatives to govern and their commitment to using the best available evidence is the tension. And I think it's actually very well solved or resolved by existing regulations and arrangements, which grew out of the biggest policy problem that the UK has faced in the last 20, 30 years, and that was mad cow disease. So a lot of our learning of how to organise and manage the tension between evidence and policy came from the analysis of what went wrong in managing BSE.
Gosh, that's almost like a historical artefact at this point. But as you mentioned, I remember that we were in touch at that point because you were interested in the whole notion of the Carlton Gadishek and the scrappy virus and so on.
Exactly.
I remember that, yeah.
Indeed.
How, in fact, then, do you balance this relationship between scientists, scientific establishment, and government? And let me be more specific. I just said that we now have an administration under President Obama with, you know, a scientific advisor, well-known John Holdren, as I said, with Eric Lander, Harold Varmus, Stephen Chu, highly respected scientists all over the place. When he came into office, President Obama talked about restoring science to its rightful place without giving any coordinates. Mm-hmm. So given what you've just been saying and given your lifetime's involvement in this, essentially, I mean, do you have a sense of what the rightful place of science is and how much scientists can expect their influence, how far it can extend and so on and so forth?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Obama made clear where he saw it. Rightful place in his speech before his inaugural address, after he'd been elected, when he said that we should listen to what our scientists say, even when it makes us uncomfortable, especially when it makes us uncomfortable. So he clearly sees the place of science as providing the evidence and advice that politicians should listen to. And you know, I'm an outsider. I don't really have the right in a way to comment on US politics, but that looks like a bit of a reaction to the Bush era, in which, you know, it's very hard to think that so-called advisors weren't to some extent being chosen because they gave the advice that the administration wanted to hear, which of course is nonsense. So that is, again, this tension. If you want the best advice, you have to be capable of listening to advice that you don't want to hear, that doesn't fit with your views and your expectations politically, that has implications that are going to be a headache to manage, like spending more money, for instance, or incapacitating, you know, an area of industry or commercial life because it poses some risk. I mean, there are all sorts of things that politicians would rather not hear from scientists. I think what Obama was saying was, well, you know, we have to listen to those things. Even though in the end the politicians must have the right, the power, to be able to overrule the advice. And if they do so, they should explain to the electorate why they've done that. I mean, openness and transparency in the relationship between advisors and government is crucial to make the process work properly. And there was not that transparency in the BSE era, and that was one of the problems that was identified in the subsequent analysis of what went wrong.
So, all right, not commenting on the States then, but if I asked you that question again about UK, and it ought to be globally, I mean, what is the rightful place of science in a society then?
Well, this is only one aspect, of course, the rightful place of science. I mean, science is the driver of innovation, and therefore of new industry, therefore of the production economy. That's been recognised around the world. So investment in science is, from that perspective, a public good, because it drives advance in the economy and improves the quality of life and health and all of those things. I mean, I would argue that another rightful place of science is deep in our culture as well, that it is a very important part of what we do as a civilised society. It's as much an enriching activity as the arts are, at the same level of the art as the arts in reinforcing our culture. So we should support science for the same reasons that we support the arts, that we're proud of it. We recognise the talent of the individuals who are doing it and recognise their general contribution to making us better people. So lots of rightful places for science. Science in culture, science in the economy, science in the advisory process.
Let me just clarify one thing about the certainly for an American audience, about the job that you did at the Medical Research Council would normally resulted in an honour in the Queen's Honours List, the award of a knighthood, so you'd be Sir Colin Blakemore. It says here from one of the front bench spokesmen on science said, the last thing on Colin Blakemore's mind is a personal knighthood. Baubles are not his consideration. What is significant here is whether the government is prepared to support scientific work. I think that's...
Well, when this incident happened, and you're referring to the unpleasant experience, there was a leak to the press. Interesting to ask why it was leaked. There was a leak to the press of a memorandum, very top secret memorandum, from the high-level committee that recommends honours to the Prime Minister. Not just knighthoods and damehoods, but a whole kind of slew of these other things with funny titles, OBEs and MBEs and everything. And the memo made odd comments, throwaway remarks, kinds of things that must have embarrassed the person who wrote them when they became public, comments on individuals. I remember it said about poor Tim Henman. You remember Henman, the great tennis hope of Britain, who never quite delivered in the way that the British would have liked him to. That it was important to add him to the list for some CBE or something, because he added a little bit of spice to the list. And it was almost in those terms, not much to do with his credit as a sportsman or an individual. And the comment about me was that. Apparently, and I knew nothing about this, the committee wished to, I'm trying to remember the arcane language, wished to advance again the name of Blakemore. But it was considered that his work, or maybe, I think it was his work on animals, was too controversial to make it appropriate to give him an honour. Well, I'd been appointed to the MRC, the Medical Research Council, the government agency with principal responsibility for medical research, including research on animals, just a few months earlier. Of course, I was offended by what I read, but my real concern, and because of it, I said that I couldn't see how I could keep the job, was that on the one hand, the government was publicly encouraging scientists, demanding that scientists should go public on their support for animal research, should talk about their research, should enter the debate about the importance of the use of animals. This is just at the stage when the government was getting extremely worried about the activist activity, the escalation of violent and sinister activities, which were, a real threat to the future of biomedical research, of the pharmaceutical industry, and so on in Britain. So the government, on one hand, was rallying scientists to the cause, saying, you've got to speak out on this issue. And on the other, apparently in secret, was saying, oh, we couldn't possibly give an honour to someone who's engaged in this rather dubious area. So I said, look, I'm going to resign unless the government makes it really very clear what its position is. I didn't say I'm going to resign unless I get a knighthood. Yeah. It's ridiculous. And I have to say, you know, within a day, Lord Sainsbury, for whom I have huge admiration, the Minister of Science, very public in reaffirming the government's commitment to the importance of the use of science. Dave King, the government chief scientist at the time, another person for whom I have the enormous respect, the same, on the Today programme, the most important radio news programme, again offering his support. Support from Tony Blair, at least in letters and correspondence from other scientists. So, I mean, that seemed to me to be a strong enough affirmation, widely reported in the press. So I withdrew my suggestion of resignation. But it really, it genuinely was a concern, not about any offence to me in not getting an honour, but you know, the reflection on the commitment of the government to a very important cause. That's what worried me.